All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session. Come on.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. We welcome you to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting today for our second day of hearings in Kootenai County. September 18, 2025, we again express our appreciation to the county commissioners and all others in this county government that have helped and has facilitated us being here and made it possible to be in this new part of the courthouse that's so wonderful to be here for. So with that, we will take up the first case of the day. It is Khalsa versus Ridenour, number 52009. In this matter, Leon Khalsa is represented by Amy Clemens, and the respondent, Donna Ridenour, is represented by Daniel McLaughlin. Counsel, we've considered some questions in our pre-hearing meeting with the court in full and made some determinations there that any documents, recordings, or other proposed material for this hearing that was not or cannot be identified to a page or location of the record will not be available during the hearing. Ms. Clemens, though, I'm giving you an opportunity to make a record in that regard if you wish at this time. Please then speak up.
With regard to the record in this case, one of the issues is, did the arbitrator make findings of fact and conclusions of law, or did he go off script? We have a full audio of arbitration that was presented between 8 days. Both parties agreed that the record for the arbitration would be an audio recording. Similar to an administrative hearing, occasionally there's not a court reporter or a transcript, and the courts have considered the audio when that is the record and it was a record that was agreed to by the parties in this case. There are snippets that I think are incredibly pertinent to the issues in this case. One is by the arbitrator, where he was suggesting that he'd like to recraft the agreement, and I would like to play that. It's only like 10 or 20 seconds.
Can you point to where in the record that is that the district court accepted it and made it part of the record? Because it appeared to us, I believe, on page 4108 of the record that that was denied. And so if that's the case, the answer would be no, and we would deny your request. If you're able to post-hearing establish through a written submission, we'll give you 7 days to do that. Where this was accepted by the court, we will certainly consider it. I can assure you and your client, this court does everything to get ready for these hearings ahead of time. We know the record inside and out. And at this juncture, as you can see, we know right on the page where this record issue occurred. We're prepared. But if you can assure me and show this court post-hearing, I will assure you that we'll take a look at that before any decision is rendered.
One of the issues that's submitted on behalf of Mr. Khalsa is like a summary judgment motion. In a motion to vacate an arbitration hearing that they exceeded their authority, this court reviews it independently to consider the record that was...
Ma'am, I'm aware of our standards, but I've made my ruling. So you can proceed now with your 20 minutes of opening argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. The issue in this case with regard to whether an arbitration should stand or not, especially when a settlement is involved, is to protect the party's right to enforce a settlement as written and as agreed between the parties themselves at the time it was placed into writing. The situation that arose here is constant requests to alter that, not based upon Donna Ridenour's intent or purpose or understanding, but based upon her family, who continuously say, we're not parties. You can't make us bound by this agreement. We don't have to comply with this. But we'd like to change it here, 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 and here. And what the arbitrator did is, I'm persuaded to make these changes. And we're going to go through each of those issues. But just to address the issues of law initially, there's a reason. Idaho law, federal law, protects the party's right to enter into a settlement. They encourage settlement, and they encourage the parties to come to a compromise. And one of the most important things in that compromise is the exchange of consideration. And the consideration in this case, and this is the FEMA map, which Mr. McLaughlin has already admitted is in the record. It is one of the pages in Exhibit 19 that was attached to the Bonner County permit. So when we're dealing with this, this is the Ridenour residence and the Halster residence. When you look at the surveys that were done, this yellow area, 20 feet by 50 feet, covered where the Ridenour deck is. So the 1994 agreements had a 25-50-foot easement across the lower half of the Ridenour property. And that occurred in 1994 because Ms. Ridenour wanted 15 more feet of the Glensby property so she could build a garage. So she wanted to move this line back and move, in exchange, gave them a 20-foot easement. When Mr. Kalsa purchased the property, she said, oh, that was just a mistake. I don't want that easement to be enforced by. That was one of the issues being tried before Judge Buchanan. In addition to the fact that Ms. Ridenour was saying, I should adversely possess the beach. Although she was making an adverse possession claim at trial, at no point in time did she claim she was adversely possessing any portion of Mr. Kalsa's property. She was just claiming she adversely possessed the beach and she had adversely possessed the easement area. Mr. Kalsa's trial brief explains why that wasn't a legally viable claim. And as we were at trial, Judge Buchanan realized when Donna Gal, the tax assessor, testified that they shared the taxes on the beach, Donna Ridenour testified that the beach was always shared. She called both parties to initiate the mediation. Neither of the parties initiated it. And she made it clear to both of them that you're going to lose on these property rights, but you're going to keep fighting. You're better off negotiating some settlements. Mr. Kalsa had full right to use this deck area because it was in his easement. Clearly, that's a very tight space. He also had the full right to use the joint patio, which was already on the beach. What they agreed to is he would relinquish that. And in that 20 by 50 foot easement, it wasn't just enjoyment and use of that property, it was ingress and egress. So he could ingress and egress anywhere within that area. He made it very clear that if he was giving that up and was just going to extend his ingress-egress easement to 12 feet, that he would also need the ability to access the beach for maintenance, because it's very clear in the agreement that both parties have the right to maintenance. So what he got is, I'll give this up, but if I'm not going to have ingress and egress across the whole thing, I'm at least going to need maintenance access, because we have equal rights to maintain the jointly owned beach. He shall have the right to build his own patio. There was a parking easement from 1994 back here that allowed Ridenours to park two cars in a 2020 area. And the purpose of that parking was overflow. So when you read that easement, it says only after they'd exhausted all the available parking on the Ridenour property could they use those two temporarily for overflow parking. So what the parties agreed is if he relinquished this, his easement would get to 12 feet, he would have a maintenance access. And one of the biggest things is he'd have his own patio so they were not sharing the space. And it was supposed to be similar and compatible to the other patio. And more important to Mr. Kalsa was he would be left in peace. Paragraph 21 of the agreement was they would stop watering his area, start spraying him with the hose, stop putting the sprinkler on for 12 hours so he couldn't use the area. They would stop the water interference and not sit within an inch of him or right next to him, that he would have his own space, because what they would do is try to crowd him out from using the beach. In addition, the 20 by 20 area would be reduced in half. One of the two spots would be relinquished. In addition, there's a large tree here, and when they built this house, they cut one side of the tree, which caused the other side to slough. So you can see Mr. Kalsa's deck, and there's a window. So he has a nice view of the lake, but nothing is parked here. What he got in exchange for giving up property, a 20 by 50 foot spot, Ms. Ridenour relinquishing this and getting his own patio, included an improved view. It included parking restrictions. It included a maintenance corridor. What ended up happening is every time he tried to exercise one of those rights, Ridenour's family members would try to prevent it. I'd like to go through a couple of the cases because it is a big decision to reverse something that the parties arbitrated.
But what's important in Wattenberger, which is cited in our brief, is it's important that they comply with the terms of the contract at the time the contract is entered. And at the time the contract was entered, the parties in paragraph 4 agreed to use the Provault survey, and that Mr. Coulson shall have the right to build this patio based upon the Provault survey pin, which was buried in the landscaping done by Donna Ridnour. So the pin gets installed in 2019. They excavate and brought in 12.8 tons of fill dirt, and it had to be unburied. The person who unburied it was Rob Ridnour, Donna Ridnour's son. The Ridnours marked the Provault pin at the time Mr. Coulson was building this patio in 2021. And when you look at pictures where there's all these strings and lines and the no trespassing signs, those were installed by the Ridnours, and they are right up against the patio. What happened in 2023 when a different survey was done, when you read all of the meets and bounds of these properties, the southern boundary line between the beach and Donna Ridnour's property is described continuously in the meets and bounds as 50 feet. When a 2023 survey got done, it's 50.27. They made it a little bit wider. So when they're saying his patio didn't touch the eastern boundary line, you're dealing with two different surveys with two different measurements. And what Wattenberger made incredibly clear, you can only comply with the terms of the contract at the time the contract is entered.
Was Wattenberger an arbitration case? Was it seeking to set aside a decision by an arbitrator?
I believe it was the court. But it's a similar standard where they're addressing when you stray from the terms of the contract.
But this is why I'm asking.
Yeah.
Because under the Uniform Arbitration Act, that is the law in the state of Idaho, I'm not seeing any grounds in 7-912 to set aside or vacate a decision by an arbitrator because he didn't hold the parties to the stipulation they entered into. What I do see is you can vacate it if you can demonstrate that the arbitrator exceeded his authority.
Yes.
And our case law establishes, when I read it, that we look to the agreement, and when we look to the agreement, we're looking not at did he hold them or to the terms of the stipulation or did he enforce the terms of the stipulation, but we're looking at the agreement to say what authority did the parties grant the arbitrator in terms of what could he arbitrate, what could he decide. And so I'm struggling because you're arguing he didn't enforce the terms of the agreement, but I think that jumps past the first inquiry, which when I look at our case law is, did the agreement give the arbitrator authority to decide these issues? And so help me understand how we jump to what I see as the merits and we get past the inquiry of, did the parties agree to submit these issues to the arbitrator?
And that's based upon the parties' briefing. And both parties briefed that this went through a process. We have mediation with Judge Buchanan. Judge Buchanan drafted that stipulated agreement and order. Both parties had the opportunity to bring motions to alter and adjust any language. And then, after her second order, the motion, ordering motions, in October of 2021, they entered into a stipulated judgment. And that stipulated judgment made very clear that they're accepting the written document as is, and all of the rights and restrictions set out in that would run with the land. One of those agreements was that the Provault survey would be used for the construction. And the Provault survey occurred in 2019, and patio was going to be built based upon that. It is a change to the contract to say we're going to use a new survey in 2023 that's 0.27 different and say that now his patio is 2.2 inches off the eastern boundary because we're moving the eastern boundary. So what Wattenberger addressed is you can only comply with the terms of the contract, and the agreement can only be based upon the information they had and agreed to in 2021.
Counsel, could we talk about the arbitration clause of the stipulation and agreement for a second?
Sure.
Where in the arbitration clause or in the alternate dispute resolution clause, which I believe is paragraph 22, where does that limit the ability of the mediator or later on the arbitrator to consider things beyond the record as it existed at the time the stipulation was entered into?
Well, when you say consider something beyond the record, you can't change the agreement. And the agreement was that Mr. Kalsa shall have the right to use the ProVault survey. That's what was determined at trial. That was what was agreed to by the party.
Well, in paragraph 22, it says that in the event a dispute arises relating to the use of the property or in relation to the various rights, agreements, and easements, and then it defines the alternate dispute resolution process. First, negotiations. Second, mediation. Third, an arbitration. I'm looking there and trying to see if there's anything there that limits or ties the hands of the mediator or the arbitrator to look at things beyond the black and white agreement that was reached and trying to resolve issues related to use.
And I appreciate that. That is what we're here to decide. Use of beach is how they were using it. Boundary lines and the survey pins were established at the trial and recognized in every single document attached to that stipulated enrollment. The easements themselves all reference 50 feet as the distance. They all reference the ProVault survey. At no point in time when the parties agree in paragraph 4 that he shall have the right to rely on that ProVault survey, does the arbitrator then have the ability to say, I'm going to go in and relitigate the boundaries to this property? There's nothing in the use of the joint beach that allows him to alter the boundaries based upon a survey that didn't exist at that time.
But isn't your argument essentially that the arbitrator made a mistake of law?
No.
And if it's a mistake of law, how does this court, or any court for that matter, come in and vacate the arbitration award? I mean, it seems to me that the Arbitration Act is very clear. If the arbitrator makes a mistake of law, that is not a reviewable matter for this court.
And it would be great if we had a ruling of law in this arbitration decision where he explains how he gets to change the boundary from 50 feet to 50.27 and how he gets to ignore the party's agreement that they were going to be entitled to rely on the ProVault survey and now use a survey that didn't exist and say at some later point in time, Rittenhouse can get a different survey and say, well, he didn't meet the 2023 survey that occurred in the winter when he dug down into the snow and he never installed one survey pin.
So, but doesn't the arbitrator explain that what he's enforcing is the provision of the agreement that says the patio should begin here and it will adjoin this particular boundary? I mean, when I read the decision, that's what I understand the arbitrator to be saying.
And he specifically says, I'm saying it doesn't adjoin the boundary, I'm accepting the 2023 boundary. And it is my position that that is the act outside the scope of his authority to change the boundary lines that were agreed to by the parties and are clearly, unambiguously set out in paragraph 4. So when something is not ambiguous, he doesn't have the ability to come in and review it and say, I think it should have been done differently. Or 3 or 4 years later, these boundaries have changed. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the antitrust case in Stolz-Nielsen, which is cited, says when a contract is silent on an issue, the arbitrator can't go in and impose their own policy. He doesn't make a ruling of law. This is how I get to change the boundary line. And use of the beach and establishing the lines of the beach are two very different things. In addition, the Stolz and Nielsen case goes into you must vacate, as does the statute in Idaho that addresses this. If they exceed their authority, there's not an option not to vacate because it's similar to a jurisdictional decision. He's making a decision outside the scope of his authority by changing the boundary lines of these properties that were agreed to by the parties. And the reason Idaho and federal law is so cautious about protecting a party's right to settle is because those parties, when they sign that agreement, have the right to rely on it and have the right to know that the only thing the arbitrator can do is enforce the unambiguous terms.
But I don't see that in any of our arbitration law. I mean, what I see our arbitration law turning on is did your agreement agree to submit the issue to the arbitrator? And if yes, then the arbitrator, our cases hold uniformly, the arbitrator has extremely broad powers. And so cite me to a case that says the arbitrator cannot deviate from the terms of the agreement, because the cases you cite in your brief for that premise are not arbitration cases. They are enforcement of settlement agreement cases. And so I need you, for me, to marry those two lines together and say, this is the case that says, even if you agreed to submit this to the arbitrator, he cannot deviate from the terms of the settlement agreement.
Stolt-Nielsen is addressing right that. And like any
contract, but is that under the Federal Arbitration Act, or is that under the Uniform Arbitration Act that Idaho has adopted?
They have the same provisions when they're reviewing, did the arbitrator exceed his authority? So the issue of what was the arbitrator's authority, again, is contractual. What did the parties agree to? In this case, both, and then secondarily, what did the parties put in their briefing as to what they were asking the arbitrator to do? And what's incredibly significant in this case, in the arbitrator's briefing, is both parties said the arbitrator has no right to modify the stipulated order or decisions by Judge Buchanan. Those are subject to res judicata and collateral estoppel. Both parties submitted, there's no ambiguity in this agreement, and we want it enforced as written. Ms. Ridenour's brief, when they were arguing it needed to enforce the agreement, the one on the record, both argued the arbitrator had no authority to alter or add to the terms of the settlement agreement. That's in the record at 2059. Everybody in their briefing to him said, you can't change this. If you find something ambiguous in it, your very limited authority is to interpret it. If you found that the party's use violated the unambiguous terms of the agreement, then you could address those use violations, not alter the agreement. In addition, the Coring case references Idaho case law does not support the Robertson's attempt to question or alter numerous stipulations contained in the settlement agreement after agreeing to each one on the record. We find the settlement agreement is enforceable against the parties. In this case, the arbitrator basically found the arbitration agreement as written isn't enforceable, and I'm going to recraft it. And that is something very, very different than a finding of fact that the ProVault survey had a boundary mark of 50, and then the 2023 survey, which is unmarked, says it's 50.27. And here's my authority. I find that a use of the beach, and here's how I get to change where that pad is located based upon future information. He doesn't do that. And what they address is you can't dispense your own brand of justice. In addition, in the Moore case, matters submitted for arbitration are relevant to determining the scope of the arbitrator's power. Our briefing saying you cannot change the terms of this language. Judge Buchanan entered that order, the parties agreed to it as written, and it was complete and not changeable at that point in time that the stipulated judgment was entered. And then it goes on to say, and must be considered along with the original agreement to arbitrate. Absent express limitations by the parties, the arbitrator has very broad authority. In this case, there was very express limitation. Both parties said there's no ambiguity, and you do not have the authority to alter the language. The agreement required that the parties bear their own costs, including it. The parties' award then contravened this express language and therefore was beyond the scope of the arbitrator's authority. That's exactly what we're dealing with here. In addition, the Tolley case says Idaho law protects the party's right to receive the benefits promised in a settlement agreement. If a party is denied the right to the benefits of the agreement they entered into, they are implicit in the agreement. Then the agreement is breached. We were asking him to find that the Ridenour's changes are breaches. He didn't even address those arguments. So what we end up, and I want to go through the specifics of each one. One of the most egregious is there's nothing that allows him to change, again, the boundaries that were litigated and agreed to before this agreement. He has the right to address use violations on the beach or violations of the written easement, not alter the written easement. The parking spot is Exhibit G attached to materials. And what Judge Buchanan did is on Exhibit 1-45, which is the second page to Exhibit 2, whereas pursuant to the stipulated settlement agreement, the parties have agreed to amend the overflow parking easement to eliminate the westerly 10-foot. She goes on to mention that Donna Ridenour hereby releases the westerly 10-foot of the overflow parking argument recorded January 11, 1995 at instrument number 458760. Leon Kalsa hereby converts the remaining overflow, one space, for exclusive use. It was previously overflow use, so now we're taking what is a recorded easement and saying this half of it's going to be released. The survey in 2023, the notes reference, his note 7, which are very, very small on the survey at the bottom. When you blow that up, it says SOA, stipulated agreement, paragraph 11, provides for a 10-foot wide parking area for Ridenour. The language in this agreement does not provide northeast southwest limits, so it could be interpreted as extending to the full length of the Kalsa property. He admitted he never looked at the 1994 easement. The arbitrator in this decision recognizes the recorded easement referenced in this document is a 20 by 20 parking area. If you relinquish one half of that, it does not become longer. What the Ridenour's attempted to say, if you just look at Judge Buchanan's stipulated order and agreement and you don't look at the recorded easements, then you don't know that it's only 20 feet. And if you don't know, you could make a mistake and go further. But additionally, this agreement said he has the right to mark it. There was no question that he marked it accurately. First he did it with wood timbers, then he did it with posts, and then he did it with paint. Judge Buchanan, when she went out there and said, well, it's going to be harder to pull in there if you have above ground markers. Not that he marked it inaccurately. Ted Deal, when he represented Ridenour, did not say he marked it inaccurately. What he said is it's going to be easier for it to be paint. And then when he put paint on the ground, they would just drive over it. The arbitrator does not say, I have the authority to change this easement. He does not identify an ambiguity in the agreement. He does not say, here's the party's interpretation that I'm resolving. He does not do what was in the scope of his authority. He says, I'm going to find it is unlimited because they've been using it for 29 years, and I'm going to quiet title some Kalsa's property to Ridenour. There is nothing in paragraph 22 that gives him any authority to do that.
Can you explain? I didn't understand the context of the fight over the parking lot at this juncture. I mean, what was going on between the parties?
Well, this all had to do with the view. Because he was going to get a view here, it was overflow.
So wait a minute. You're using words that are vague, like the view here.
There. His window is marked on the survey. And so you see the Kalsa residence and the window. And when you look at any of the pictures, that view was straight down to the lake. And in Exhibit 89, Walt Dale's exhibit, Kalsa Exhibit C, attached to the survey, the purple area there is where you would have the view to the lake. So the entire basis was if you only had overflow parking, what we were going to do, which is in paragraph 18, which is incredibly clear, is you are going to be required to exhaust the parking between the Kalsa and Ridenour residence on the western side from the garage and exhaust the one now regular parking spot behind the Kalsa garage before you park anywhere else. And it says the purpose of that very clear exhaustion requirement is to not block the window. What Ridenour has tried to claim is, well, if we park in front of the garage, that really doesn't block his window because we didn't agree to a view easement. They agreed to a parking restriction that is unclear that there's an obligation to exhaust, and the only benefit to Mr. Kalsa is an improved view, which was the same reason for cutting that tree. So when the arbitrator says, I'm going to take paragraph 18, which requires them to exhaust those three spots before they park anywhere else, which was the consideration for him giving up this property, I'm going to rewrite it and say they don't have to exhaust those three spots and can park there. What's incredibly significant about the scope of authority is Judge Buchanan addressed that exact issue in the October motion, which is clearly set out in the transcript. Both parties, when you're saying what was submitted to the arbitrator, both parties said you do not get to second-guess Judge Buchanan or alter those decisions. The parking restriction is exactly that.
I disagree. And she was presented the same thing. Well, it's 30 feet away, so it's not blocking the window. When you ask them what was the purpose of blocking the window language, the intent, it was a view. It wasn't a view easement, because if they exhausted these two spots and this spot, they could then park there. But the parking restriction in paragraph 18 is not unclear that that mandatory requirement to exhaust would run with the land. It very clearly says it will apply to all of her agents and family members. And their position is, we weren't parties, so we don't have to park there. We asked the arbitrator to make a decision on agency law that agents are bound by the contract, that the stipulated judgment says it applies to her heirs. They're saying, and that's the only thing he put in his brief, is the arbitrator can't hold them to that language.
Counsel, can I ask you a question before you? I want to make sure I get this in before you run out of time. You've kept referring to Judge Buchanan's decision. Judge Buchanan didn't actually make a decision in this case, did she?
Yes.
She just took an agreement, and the parties disagreed about what their agreement was. So then she said, this is my understanding of what the agreement was. The agreement contained a mediation clause and an arbitration clause. Isn't the arbitrator's decision in this case the actual first real decision that was made by someone acting in a judicial capacity?
No, because in the process, after she issued her stipulated agreement and order, she gave both parties the opportunity to bring motions to say, does this language need to be adjusted? And that occurred in August, September of 2021.
Right. But my question about Judge Buchanan's decision, as you've been describing it, Judge Buchanan never actually made a decision about the legal issues. The only decision she made is what the agreement reached by the parties was. Is that correct?
Well, I believe it's both. What she was saying is the language in paragraph 18 is clear, and Ridnour's argument that they should get to park in front of the garage.
Again, you're talking about paragraph 18. I'm talking about, I'm taking a step further back from that. This agreement was an order of the court, wasn't the result of an adjudicated proceeding. It was just the court attempting to memorialize the agreement that had been reached in court to the best of its ability. And then the parties went to an arbitrator to actually litigate the issues that got stopped halfway through the trial before Judge Buchanan.
She was making a ruling on, is this written document complete? And two issues presented to her. They wanted to not move their sprinklers until the patio was done, and she said, no, you have to do it immediately. So that October order is an enforceable order, is a decision. She also says, because she was the mediator, she drafted this agreement, she knew this agreement, and she knew the intent of it, that no, you do not get out of exhausting these three parking spaces and get to park in front of the garage. And both parties, when you say what is submitted to the arbitrator, is based upon their briefing. Both parties agreed the arbitrator did not have the authority to change her decisions or change anything in the written document. When you look at it, he is recrafting the agreement based upon what he thinks should fit. And that included, I'm gonna let her adversely possess a portion of the parking spot, make it longer than the written documents provide. I am going to rewrite paragraph 18, which is now recorded, and said they can park in front of the garage without exhausting the three spots. He does not say there's something ambiguous in paragraph 18. He rewrites it and creates an exception, which is adding language. With the patio, he says, well, I'm going to find it has to be a parallelogram. No one testified that it was going to be a parallelogram or parallel. It was going to be similar and consistent and compatible to the other patio.
Ms. Clemons, I hate to interrupt, but you are out of time. Thank you. Your 30 minutes is up then.
Oh, I'm getting a 10 minutes.
You're 10 minutes over your initial 20.
Oh, I apologize.
Well, that was fine. You are now out of time. McLaughlin.
Thank you. May it please the court and the Chief Justice, Justices, Madam Clerk. My name is Toby McLaughlin. I am the attorney for Donald Ridnour in this case. He is the respondent, as you know. The The summary of this appeal, in my words, is it's an appeal of the trial court's decision to deny Leon Kalsa's amended motion to vacate, correct, and stay the arbitration award, which was denied by the Bonner County District Court in its entirety. The standard of review for this, as I believe you understand, is that judicial review of the arbitrator's decision is much more limited than that of trial. Arbitrators are the final judges of law and fact. An inquiry by a district court is limited to an examination of the award to discern if any of the grounds for relief stated in the Uniform Arbitration Act exist. And that is the same question, I think, that's presented to this court. An arbitrator's rulings on questions of law and fact are binding, even where erroneous, unless one of the enumerated statutory grounds is present. That's in the Moore versus Omnicare case. I will point out initially that there are a lot of places in the Mr. Kalsa's briefing, which isn't supported by citations to the record at all. There are many more that are citations to items that are not in the record. I'm not going to belabor that point, but I will point that out. I will also point out, as the court recognized, in the record at 4108 through 4110, the district court settled the record or denied Ms. Clemens a motion to add additional documents, being the audio recordings and other items. So those are not before the court. Understand the court understands that already. Briefly, the history, we have a different view of the history. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but Ms. Ridenour and her late husband owned these parcels previously. They owned all the way to the waterfront. Ultimately, they had a dispute with the Galinskis. It resulted in recognition of an easement on the waterfront property. That then, once Mr. Kalsa bought the property, another dispute arose. That dispute ended in a mediated solution by Judge Buchanan, as the court knows. Judge Buchanan, the parties were unable to, I mean, the agreement was read into the record, but then they couldn't agree as to the specifics. So Judge Buchanan went ahead and did that herself. The parties then filed motions to reconsider. She filed an order rate motions, which slightly modified it, but that is the settlement agreement that we have here. Judge Buchanan didn't make any ruling on that. My client didn't even get a chance to present any evidence. She was the defendant. And the case settled before her case that she just started. What's before the court now is the scope of the judicial or the arbitrator's authority. I mean, the only one of those five items listed that Mr. Kalsa asked for is the exceeding the authority, I mean, in an arbitration statute. He presents an argument of bias now on appeal that wasn't brought up to the district court and isn't properly before the court. The question, of course, about whether or not an arbitrator exceeded his authority is set forth in Mumford versus Miller. It says, normally courts interpret the provisions relating to exceeding the arbitrator's powers to mean that the arbitrator considered an issue not submitted or that he exceeded the bounds of the contract between the parties. So that's the question, I think, that's before this court today. And such submission, this is in the Mumford case, such submission to the arbitrator necessarily contemplates the arbitrator will have to exercise the factual and legal judgment that the parties bargained for when they agreed that disputes concerning their contract would be submitted to an arbitrator. In the, I don't know if I'm saying it right, Chisione versus Bingall case, the court said, because the arbitrator in this case considered an issue that was clearly submitted to him, and did not exceed any limitations contained in the party's agreement, we conclude that he did not exceed his powers. So that brings up the question, okay, what are the powers or authority of the arbitrator in this case? That turns to paragraph 22 of the settlement agreement. It says, in the event a dispute arises between the parties relating to the use of the joint beach property, or in relation to the various rights, agreements, and easements established by this order, the ADR procedures apply, and we got all the way through arbitration in this case. So that's what defines the arbitrator's authority, as opposed to his power. Now, all of the issues that we're talking about here today were clearly submitted to the arbitrator. Every single one of them. The patio, maintenance corridor, parking, everything else. We spent 8 grueling days in arbitration at my office, in our conference room, days that sometimes lasted into the evening. Going through all this, we presented numerous witnesses, both parties did. Both parties had surveyors provide expert testimony. In fact, the survey exhibit that Ms. Kalsa keeps claiming changed the line here Mr. Paulson keeps doing is their survey, their own expert survey. Nobody changed any boundary line in this case. What the arbitrator did is simply interpreted the agreement and applied it as he was hired to do, as both parties requested him to do.
Can you address the arbitrator's rulings on the parking and the exhaustion of the other spots? How is that not changing the agreement?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. What the arbitrator heard was a lot of testimony about that issue, about a lot of these issues, but that one in particular. One of the things that if you look back at the record or the settlement as it was read into the transcript, into the record orally, it talked about simply the reason for that was not to block his window. That was the language. Both parties agreed that that language fully contemplated the agreement. And then ultimately, it was changed a little bit when Judge Buchanan ultimately wrote the decision itself. The point being, I think, the arbitrator's position was to, and he heard testimony. I mean, there was a motion filed by Mr. Khalsa to sanction Ms. Ridenour for people parking by her garage. And Judge Buchanan heard that motion, saw the same pictures, a lot of the same pictures, not all of them, the same exact pictures that were presented at arbitration and by alleged violations. And Judge Buchanan ruled that there were no violations. In the order of motions, she didn't find any parking violations. The arbitrator, I believe, interpreted that evidence as, okay, well, the agreement does require the exhaustion before you can park in front of this window, but that the parking in front of the garage isn't parking in front of this window. And I think the arbitrator found exactly that. So what I'm suggesting is that is an issue. The parking is a right for the restrictions, the parking restrictions and the right to park on Mr. Costa's property are rights defined by the arbitration agreement. I'm sorry, the settlement agreement. So the question for the court isn't whether or not the arbitrator made a correct decision there or correct interpretation. It is whether or not the arbitrator had the authority to do that. And because of that right relates to the settlement agreement, which it clearly does, the arbitrator had the authority to do it, and both parties asked him to resolve the issues.
And so when we consider the scope of the arbitrator's authority, does the arbitrator have authority to disregard portions of the agreement, deviate from portions of the agreement, or rewrite portions of the agreement?
I think arguably yes, and I say that only because if you look at the Perryman case, I think the Perryman case is instructive. Bear with me. The Perryman case was just issued late last year by the Court of Appeals. And in that case, it was a dispute between a builder and a developer. And ultimately, the developer demanded that the builder cure a bunch of construction defects that he alleged. So there was a $2.2 million job, five different buildings. The builder showed up to cure those within the 30 days of demand. And then the developer showed up and said, get the blank off my property, thus preventing him from going. And so then the argument, it went to arbitration, pursuant to arbitration, and the arbitrator found that that statement by the developer prevented the builder from going ahead and finishing the project, and therefore found in favor of the builder. One of the issues on appeal by the developer was that is a change of the contract. That does not follow what the contract says. The contract says there are no modifications to the contract unless they're in writing. And you, arbitrator, exceeded your authority by changing the agreement by allowing an oral modification. There were a couple more points just like that. And ultimately, what this court, the Court of Appeals, said was, that's not the question before the court here. The question is simply whether or not the arbitrator's authority is limited in some way. And the arbitration clause in that case was very similar to the one in this case. It contained no limitations. It just said, if any dispute arising out of that contract, submit to arbitration. And so the Court of Appeals, I think, correctly found we can't second-guess the arbitrator, even if you were to argue that it isn't a change to the underlying contract. That's just the question, just simply is whether the arbitrator has the authority to do it.
And so when we're considering authority, to what extent does the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, Stolt-Nielsen, addressing a similar, did the arbitrator exceed their authority provision in the FAA,
right,
Federal Arbitration Act, to what extent do we apply the statements in that case, which suggests that the arbitrator cannot deviate from the terms of the agreement, can only interpret the terms of the agreement. To what extent do those statements apply here where the arbitrator is acting under the Uniform Arbitration Act?
Right. It's obviously a federal case, but I get that. And from my reading of that case, what I understand the courts have said there is that if the policy, the court interpreted what the arbitrator did there is to make a judgment based upon public policy reasons, to essentially rewrite and change things based on policy reasons. And I don't think there's any application of that case to this. The arbitrator didn't change any boundary lines. All the arbitrator did in this case was interpret the terms of the settlement agreement.
What about with regard to the parking?
Yeah, I believe that the arbitrator is found that based upon all of the evidence admitted at the 8-day arbitration, not just the language, even some trying to interpret the intent of the parties. And the intent of the parties for the arbitration decision was not to park in front of the window. And he interpreted that as if the parking is done 30 feet from the house itself, or more than 30 feet, it's not blocking the window. And so therefore, he didn't say you can't, the exhaustion portions of that are ineffective. What he said is you can't park in front of the window unless the other spots are exhausted. He just simply interpreted that the portion that isn't right in front of his window wasn't applicable to that parking restriction. That's how I believe he did it. And I don't think that's a policy. I think it's an interpretation issue.
Can you address the quiet title?
Absolutely.
Order, because I'm struggling with that one, how he had authority to quiet title.
Yeah. First of all, there is no adverse possession. Adverse possession, of course, is ownership. Now, 20 years under current statute, 20 years of open, notorious, continuous use, potentially payment of taxes, that's adverse possession. The arbitrator didn't rule that Montgomery Network owns that area. What the arbitrator did was interpret the easement itself. Now, when the settlement agreement and order was issued, it contained attached to it, well, one of the many things was the easement regarding the parking. That easement does not define where, how long the length of that parking area. It simply says 10 feet. You know, I guess it's east to west, I think, I'm thinking about it. But, and ultimately, the parties, not being aware of the length, would park up against Mr. Kalsa's garage. There's no physical way to park any further than that in that parking area, which is, I think, approximately less than 2 feet from where Mr. Kalsa alleged the 20 feet would end. Now, there was also testimony at trial that the right-of-way of the road, which comes at an angle in there, wasn't where he said it was. I mean, sorry, not trial, but arbitration. And so ultimately what the arbitrator said is that area between the northern part of his garage and the road, that's subject to the easement. He interpreted the easement, which doesn't have a length. So when I read the arbitration decision, I view it as the arbitrator saying, well, because it doesn't have a length, I have to make a decision. In order to decide whether or not on the Rittenhour, through her gas, are parking outside of that, I have to decide that 1 or 2 feet between the garage and what Mr. Carlson admits is the easement. And he ruled that because there's no length in the easement, it is intended to be up to the garage.
Right, but there's a distinction between saying, here's the boundaries, there's no length, I'm going to interpret this and tell you what the length is. There's a difference between that and saying, I'm going to quiet title. And I'm struggling with how the arbitrator has authority to say, and I'm going to quiet title.
Yeah, maybe it's an unfortunate use of the words quiet title, but I think the ruling is clear that all he's talking about there is an easement. It's the parking easement. I mean, I've never viewed that as even a colorable argument that my client owns that area. I think quiet title is, and I file quiet titles all the time. I'm also a real estate litigator. Quiet title, in my mind, I do them with reasons all the time, you know, in order to establish a prescriptive easement for something else.
Right, but if the part of the order quieting title was vacated, that's no concern.
I think the part of the order that indicates that the easement goes to the garage, I think that part is fine, but if the words quiet title, I don't know if those make any difference to me, because it's certainly not ownership. I'm not alleging it is. My client's not alleging it is.
And then can you address the part of the arbitrator's order where he sets a deadline to construct the patio and then imposes a daily fine after that? Because I didn't see either party ask for that. What I saw from the Rittenhour brief was remediate the area and construct a patio that's in accordance with the agreement. So I'm also struggling with what was the arbitrator's authority to say, and I'm going to impose a deadline by yeah. which you have to construct this.
I understand that. And from my perspective, I think what the arbitrator was attempting to do is make sure that Mr. Falsa just doesn't leave it how it is, despite his ruling. He was attempting to create a remedy, which I think is within his right, because he found that Mr. Falsa reached the settlement agreement by building the patio where it wasn't supposed to be built. I think the agreement's fairly clear as to where it should have been built. Arbitrator certainly agreed with that, found that it was unambiguous. Now, in terms of his authority, I would just submit that the arbitration clause in the stipulated agreement order does not contain any limitations. So I think the arbitrator's authority is simply to make decisions based upon or any issue that relates to the use of the Front Beach property and or rights and easements in that agreement. And without question, the patio is entirely on the Front Beach property. It falls right within that first provision. So I think the arbitrator can say, hey, you need to do this. Now, I will note that the $200 a day penalty is stayed. You know, we stipulated that. That is not accruing right now. At this point, though, to your point, Justice Sun, I think the arbitrator's authority isn't limited by the Arbitration Act or by the arbitration agreement in the court.
But your client may have agreed to stay it right now, but you could seek to enforce it in the future.
I believe so. And that ultimately, I think, would be up to the district court to decide, you know, the enforcement of this of the arbitration agreement. That is it.
To be clear about what we're talking about here, did the arbitrator say, I am hereby quieting title and order the title be quieted, or did the arbitrator say that Ridnour is entitled to a quiet title judge?
I think it's a good question. I don't have that
portion. And obviously, I was quoting from the ruling. It says, my ruling is that both the east and west lines of the 10-foot parking easement do and shall intersect with the southern right-of-way, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Kalsa shall do nothing to impede or frustrate the use by Ms. Ridnour, her guests, or invitees. Ms. Ridnour is entitled to a quiet title judgment to that 10-foot parking space.
Right. And then we ultimately converted that to a judgment. Frankly, I don't know off the top of my head. I just don't have it in front of me, and I don't remember what that language is used.
When you say you converted it to a judgment, who signed the judgment?
Judge Jensen did.
So this was just a legal finding that someone was entitled to, but it wasn't actually quite entitled by the arbitrator.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think legal judgments by the arbitrator are not reviewable, respectively. I mean, that's just what it is. Ultimately, Judge Jensen is required by the Arbitration Act to enter a judgment confirming that, which she did here.
And that's what I'm getting at. I mean, regardless of the language that the arbitrator used, my concern is at some point now or in the future, your clients could go in and say, Judge Jensen, we're entitled to a quiet title judgment. Here you go. Arbitration agreement. Issue's been decided. And that's why I'm struggling with what is the arbitrator's authority to make that determination.
And from my perspective, it is simply a ruling on the interpretation.
Right, but with the contentious history here, I'm concerned about leaving something in there that you read one way now, but a future attorney may read it differently, and as more time passes, maybe we have entirely new counsel on the case and perhaps a new district court as well, and we're left arguing, you know, 5-10 years from now, what did this mean?
Understood. I will say that, you know, at no point in the arbitration award does it say that he owns it. My client, Tom Ridnour, owns that area. And from my perspective, the words quiet title do not denote necessarily ownership.
And I just struggle where it's a term of art, you know, and the arbitrator is a lawyer. And so when you start throwing terms of art in, I understand what you're saying, but it's just part of I struggle with it.
Understood. And I guess the only thing I can say about that is ultimately if somebody were to go in front of the district court, whether that's me or somebody else, and try to make that argument, I don't think it would hold much water. I mean, if you look at the arguments we were making in the arbitration, simply that the easement extended to that garage, And we never, ever made an argument that we did. I don't think the arbitrator said that. And the judgment certainly didn't say that. So I think that's a position for me. Any other questions?
Sure, sir. I'm not.
Okay. Well, I'll just briefly address a few more issues. And the district court, I think, correctly ruled in this case, and the district court did what I think this court should do, which is recognize that the issues decided by the arbitrator were either related to the use of the joint beach property or in relation to the various rights, agreements, and easements established by this order, and that's exactly what they did. I'll also point out that I don't believe Mr. Colasa argued below, first of all, that there was bias, I pointed that out earlier, or that did not argue to the district court that the arbitrator decided issues not submitted to him in arbitration. I think that's a new argument on appeal. That was my position. With respect to the actual, I don't know how much the court would like to go into it, the patio itself, it's not that this court's, I guess, inclination, I would say, or instruction by the precedent to involve itself in whether or not the arbitrator's rulings were correct. But I will say that the arbitrator's ruling on the patio, I think, is supported by more than substantial evidence. I think the only way a reasonable interpretation of the description is that the patio was supposed to be built right on the corner. It says
right on what?
The patio is supposed to be built right on the boundary lines of the shared beach property, meaning the northern boundary line and the eastern boundary. Turns out those boundary lines aren't 90 degrees, so the patio footprint, I should say, is angled. And that doesn't prevent Mr. Colasa from building a square patio if that's what he wants. It just would be slightly smaller than the patio footprint, if you get my point. But the patio footprint is still a bit.
You have to say that again.
Yeah, sure. So if you have an angled boundary line like this, you could still build a square patio within it. You would just have to, you wouldn't utilize the edges of it for the patio itself. Nothing in the settlement agreement, an order, or in the transcript ever said that this patio had to be square. And there's no evidence of that. We had all of my client's relatives that participated in the settlement, which there were several, because my client is elderly and now at home. They all said that was never discussed during the final stages of that. It's simply, you just can't build a square patio in an angled deal. But you can still build a patio that takes up the entire 13 foot. It's just be an angled patio, which we presented to the arbitrator plenty of pictures of patios that had circles or had shapes. Nothing that prevents that. It's just that's a decision that Mr. Colasa would make. But what that doesn't mean is that Mr. Colasa has the unilateral right to locate the patio somewhere that the parties didn't agree, which is exactly what he did. To make it both square and 13 by 13 feet, he shifted the top of the patio to the west by 21 inches. And that means that he took over a portion of the joint beach property that wasn't his for his exclusive use. It was jointly owned by my client and him. Ms. Clemens talks about there's no consideration to Mr. Colasa if he doesn't get his way here. But the reality is what he got, one of the primary considerations, half ownership in beach property. That didn't exist before that settlement. All he had was an easement for the use of the beach. Somehow, I don't know how, I wasn't part of that, but during that settlement conference, Ms. Rittenhour agreed to giving half ownership of the beach. That's huge, rather than the easement, in my opinion. And that certainly is consideration for the settlement itself, so if that was an issue. The other issue, of course, is the maintenance corridor. I'll address that briefly. The maintenance corridor, it's somewhat ironic because what essentially the language in the maintenance corridor is simply that it be 8 feet to the west of the what was to become Mr. Colasa's patio. And it defines where that patio is, so it's just to the west. That's the plain language reading of that. It's clear as it can be. What Mr. Colasa has asked the arbitrator to do, and now this court, is to change that language. Now, it's ironic because she says you can't change it, but the only way to interpret how he does it is to entirely rewrite that description so that the entry goes all the way up through the north part of my client's property and connects to their existing meaning. That language can't reasonably be interpreted that way just on its face. And so what he's asking is a change. That's, again, an issue for the arbitrator to decide. There's no question that that maintenance corridor is a creature completely of the stipulated agreement order. It wouldn't exist without it. And therefore, that was an issue before the arbitrator within his authority to decide. He sat through 10 days of evidence, 8 days of evidence, and made that decision.
So, as I read the arbitrator's decision, he moves the corridor to a certain extent and says it'll run over the patio. It won't run to the west of the footprint. Am I reading that correctly?
That is not how I read it, Justice Hahn. How I read it is he is saying that the patio, once it's properly located, put it where it's supposed to go. I believe how he describes it as the western boundary of patio, or the maintenance corridor, will be the eastern boundary of that patio footprint. So, and then it's 8 feet that follow that over. So it literally follows the language that's in the stipulated agreement order.
And why is the arbitrator talking about ramps and all of that if it's to the west of the patio footprint?
I think what the argument is Mr. Khalsa, once you go north of the joint beach property, where the maintenance corridor is not, according to the arbitrator, his easement stops, basically goes right down to the patio. But there isn't an easement from the access easement to the maintenance corridor. So in order to bring equipment over, you would have to then put a ramp down and run it down the patio and get it that way. But he could use the maintenance corridor for storing of materials or things like that he'd be entitled to while maintaining, like a parking tractor or whatever. But that's how I interpret the arbitrator order to be. And that is based on, I think, a plain language reading of the stipulated agreement. Less than 3 minutes here, I'll be quick. The sprinkler issue, there are a lot of disputed facts with regard to the sprinkler. My clients testified that they did comply with the sprinkler mandate. They set their sprinklers to go off at 5 a.m. Theirs have to be done by 5:30. That's done. They adjusted their sprinklers to not hit his patio. They capped one of the sprinkler heads that was near the patio. And ultimately, there was pictures shown that water sometimes got on the patio. And my client's explanation was, well, we certainly set it. We went out there to do it. But they're not up 5 o'clock watching the sprinkler every day. But sometimes it'd be windy, and so the sprinklers would come on in the morning automatically, and wind would blow water onto it. Or fluctuations in water pressure might happen, which is what the arbitrator found. And there was no intent, the arbitrator found there was no intent to water his patio at 5 a.m. in the morning when no one's using it. And sometimes it inadvertently occurred. And that there is an order that once he relocates his patio correctly, my client still is required to readjust and redo their sprinklers to make sure that the patio, which is their intent. But that can't happen until we know exactly where the patio is, or else they could be destroyed when the patio is destroyed. So I think the sprinkler issue is properly resolved by the arbitrator, certainly one that's in its discretion and authority. We talked about the parking issue, at least the... I would argue that the arbitrator did not rewrite the district courts, did not rewrite the stipulated order. He simply interpreted it based upon, and there's no way he couldn't have made those decisions. He was asked to sanction my client for certain things. He was asked to clarify whether or not the patio is built in the right spot, asked to decide where the maintenance corridor is located. All those things were put to him. He had to make those decisions. One party's not going to be happy with it on those decisions. Ultimately, that turned out to be Mr. Khalsa. That is not a basis to come before this court and ask for to rewrite the agreement. Last thing I'll say is motion for fees on, or request for fees on this appeal. The case law says that if all you do is come before the court and ask the court to essentially reweigh and re-decide the arbitration decision, that is frivolous and itself under 12-121. We also have a contract clause that requires no litigation. Thank you.
Let me ask you, a question on that contract clause. I read it to only award fees connected with the arbitration itself. I don't see it to speak to if there's a to award fees in a subsequent proceeding before the district court or on appeal.
Right. I agree that it does not specifically say that. And that came up in the Perryman case, too. They argued that it didn't talk about appeal, it talked about the arbitration, which is exactly what the clause says here. In my mind, this is just a follow-up to the arbitration here. I think in the Perryman case, they also said to enforce, which ours does not say. But in the Perryman case, they upheld the award also on 12-121 because it's essentially asking the court to agree with the evidence. So, it's a point well taken. I think the language, I think, could be read that way, but I understand the question. Any questions?
With that, thank you very much, counsel. This matter is under advisement. We will now take a brief recess and render a decision here accordingly.
All rise, please.